Hello and welcome to Cruising Through History. I am Xander Miller, sitting here with Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, Xander, I thought today we would talk about the 1938 broadcast of War of the Worlds by Orson Welles.
Yeah, War of the Worlds. I think I'm pretty sure I've read that.
Right.
But yeah. I did not. It was a radio show first, wasn't it?
It was a book first.
Okay.
By H.G. Wells. This is where it gets confusing, because H.G. Wells, with no E, it's W-E-E-L-S, he wrote the book in 1898.
Okay.
And he actually wrote the book, interestingly enough, as a rejoinder to the British government for their treatment of the Tasmanians. In at the time, British imperialism was at its height, and Wells was an anti-imperialist, so he wrote this book, but he made it like, well, how would, because his brother said to him, I wonder how the British would feel if, like, another race came here. He said, that'd be a good idea for a book. So in the book, it takes place in southern England, where the Martians come and invade the country. So Orson Welles, I hope I don't make this mistake too many times, he had an idea of adapting it for a radio play in 1938. So he had, they were looking for something to do for Halloween. And him and John Houseman, who some people may know as an actor who was later in movies like The Paper Chase and these other things, he was in commercials too, but they were trying to think of, they weren't really keen on it. They came up with War of the Worlds, but for some reason, neither one of them read the book.
So they did this, it's basically based on the story, but it's not a direct adaptation.
Right, because what Wells would do, and he did this with other adaptations, he would set it somewhere else. So instead of England, they set the adaptation in the United States. And he had done this before. In fact, Wells was a director in the Federal Theater Project, which was part of the WPA during the New Deal. And he actually did a remake of Macbeth with an all-African-American cast. And he actually changed the location to Haiti instead of where it was in Macbeth and Denmark, I think. And so that's what he would do with his adaptations. He would put them in different places.
Okay. Give it a little unique spin, given
potential
to reach an audience. Okay.
Right. So they get this idea, and it was called the Mercury Theater on the Air. And it was, because Wells was doing all kinds of work in theater and radio. In fact, Orson Welles was the original voice of The Shadow. If anybody remembers that old radio show from like the 30s, he did the voice of The Shadow. You know, what lurks in the heart of men? I remember that part. Not much else, though. So they came up with this idea. Now, they would always write these scripts like the week before they had to do the thing.
I know that feeling as a writer sometimes, but
right.
Yeah.
And so Houseman was going to write the script, but he couldn't really get it. So they hired a guy named Howard Koch to write the script. And I always think of how, so in the story that they adapted, they chose a place called Grover's Mill, New Jersey, for the aliens to crash in. Poor Grover's Mills, because all Koch did was he opened a map and he closed his eyes and he pointed somewhere.
So that's where a lot of the, you know, when you see cartoons and there's just like, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and they point to the map.
Yep.
This is like that inspiration.
And Grover's Mill was a rural community outside of Trenton, New Jersey.
Oh, no.
And so they write the script, and no one's feeling it. They're like, this is too dull. We got to think of a different way to approach this. And Wells had remembered that there on October 27th, now, it aired on October 30th, the show aired. But on October 27th, there was a radio play that aired called Air Raid by the poet Archibald MacLeish, who used news bulletins in the show.
Okay.
So Wells had been at the rehearsals of Air Raid and actually had seen the script in galleys before it aired on the 27th of October. So I think he had that idea in his head, because he said, well, how can we jazz this up? And he said, well, let's make it like it's just going to be a musical program with these bulletins interspersed in them.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can already see where the misinterpretation can happen.
Oh dear. Let's talk about what happens when you put in a musical program and you have these interruptions going on. What's
it was very interesting, because I listened to the show. It's on YouTube. It's remastered or something. But is it interesting how they did it? Because I could see how some people could have been fooled. Because all of a sudden there's music. All of a sudden there's this bulletin just in, and then they'll start talking. Now, the context of this is the 1930s. And we sort of touched on this when we talked about the horror genre and the effects World War I had on that.
Yeah.
I mean, fear was a thing in the 30s because you had the Depression. Mm-hmm. You always had crises. You had the Hindenburg disaster, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. You had all these things going on, disasters.
And how people hear about that, radio, news, papers, yep. Things like that.
And radio was new, but it was also, they were always doing that. They were always cutting into shows with bulletins. Mm-hmm. That was their thing. And so you can see where someone might think, is this real? And not only that, but in September of 38, you had just gone through the Sudeten crisis with Hitler. The world was on the brink of war. So I think people were used to hearing these bulletins. And really, in that era, Depression, 80% of Americans had radios. Some of them gave up stuff but kept their radio because that was their lifeline. You know, that's how they got their information. That's how they got their news. Sort of like how people have the internet now.
Yeah, like social media. Like people, I say people. Like I'll just go not to find, you know, a tweet, but just what's trending and what's going on in the world. And it'll just be there to look at, to see what's
right,
going
and radio
on.
Really cut into the revenue of newspapers in the 30s. And that'll play... That'll play into the story later when we talk. So when you listen to it, it is interesting because it sounds like it's an actual news broadcast, not a show. And I think another reason was the Mercury Theater on the air. It was on, it aired on Sunday nights at 8:00 Eastern time. It went against a show called the Chase and Sanborn Hour. Now, that means really nothing, but the reason it's something is because it was Edgar Bergen and he was a ventriloquist, and he had this dummy named Charlie, and they would start the show. And at that time, they had about 34.7% of the possible listeners, whereas the Mercury Theater had 3.6. Mm-hmm. But after about 10 minutes, Bergen would turn the microphone over to one of the singers, and people would start doing what they call dial twisting, which is like channel surfing. So I did a little experiment with this.
You did an experiment for prep? Okay.
When I was listening to this, I would take certain time. So I said, okay, I'm going to listen to about 9 minutes and something. So I'm pretending I'm listening to the Charlie Bergen show, and then I'm going to flip over. Well, if you get to about 9 minutes and 40 seconds of the broadcast, there's music playing. But at 10 minutes, 20 seconds, or wait, yeah, 20 seconds later, there's a bulletin. And then this goes on between the 10 and 11 minute mark. So if you're just twisting and you come across this, you're hearing music, and then you hear something's crashed in New Jersey. So you hear it as a bulletin.
Okay.
And so I kept doing this because that's how he would do it. Wells was really, you know, they always say he's a genius, but when he did this, he really was onto something. And I don't know if some people agree it wasn't great, but, and so that's how it would go. And really, and even, you know, we talked about the Hindenburg disaster. One of the actors that did this, his name was Frank Reddick. He played a character called Carl Phillips, who was an announcer. He was the news guy on the scene. He actually went and listened to the old recordings of the Hindenburg disaster and emulated what that guy was doing. So there was a lot of that, how he talked and how he would sound frantic and that kind of thing. And it's just very interesting how they did this.
So he made it, part of the catch here was how believable it was.
Yes.
How they're like researching that disaster, Hindenburg disaster, copying the speaking style. Like it's essentially like how people do research for acting nowadays too. It's just right. Like who's done it and what, I guess if you're looking at a news broadcast, how do they show panic? How do they have a just in or breaking news? How do they come in with that and make it real? This is the same way. And then the way they had it happen in the show made it, people felt like, oh, this is really serendipitous how we're getting to this. And then suddenly I'm hearing this and I'm like, oh, I'm caught now. What's going on? So it's all of that combined is making how this became, well, I guess we'll talk about how what happened next for how people reacted to the show.
So they're doing the show, and they have no idea what's going on. At about 8:30, that's when the switchboards start lighting up at CBS in New York and all over the country. Mm-hmm. So they have no idea what's going on, and in fact, one of the CBS executives was going to rush in and stop the show. And John Houseman like physically got in his way so he couldn't enter the studio so they could keep going. And they were telling Orson, take a station break. And Orson stayed with what he was doing till like 10 minutes later. Then he took a break. I don't think they had any idea what was going on out there. And we will talk about that a little bit too. And so it was sort of like pandemonium was going to start breaking out in the studio, and they kept doing the show.
And it was seriously that believable that they had the big news corporation being like, what's going on? Like no one else could, like no one communicated somehow, some way, confirm, deny.
Well, there were about four announcements during that hour that this was a work of fiction. In fact, even how we have TV listings. Well, used to have TV listings in a newspaper. You still do. But I mean, most people check other sources. But that's how they had these radio shows. And if you look like in the New York Times, it says 8 o'clock, War of the Worlds, radio play. So if you saw that, you'd know it wasn't true. But, you know, what I mean, you think about, you know, just you have an alien army invading. Just substitute alien with German, mm-hmm. You know. And fear makes people do sometimes things they wouldn't do.
And if you just like tuned into it at that moment, you didn't get all those announcements.
Right, and if it's all garbled and you're thinking, what's someone's invading? Mm-hmm. Someone of them may not have even thought it was aliens. Like I said, they may have thought it was an army invading or some kind. And so this sets off a bit of a panic. There's a lot of debate about how much of a panic there was and how much of this Wells was actually really sorry for. Because it certainly helped him, and but yeah, so they're doing it, and if you listen to the second half of the show, it kind of slows down. A lot of this stuff happens in the first half of the show, and another thing Wells would do is he would have these silences, which when you listen to it, it's kind of like, wow, what happened?
Well, radio silence is a no-go most of the time,
and he would do it in places where you know it would be real. Like you, if you thought so, this Carl Phillips is the—he's the broadcaster, he's the reporter, and he's reporting back to the station. This is how it's working, and he goes, "Okay, they're opening, and I see big tentacles coming out of the thing, and they're shooting lasers or something," and all of a sudden he's in the middle of a sentence and it stops, and there's this silence for like 20 seconds. And what's happening is Orson's in the studio with his hands up. I'm calling him Orson like he's my personal friend or something. And yes, radio, and our listeners will know, I actually have my hands up right now when I'm doing this. And so he has his hands up holding everything. Like, don't make a sound. And then he would bring the music back. And then someone would come on and say, we regret to inform we've lost our connection to... So someone else would jump on and say, to our reporter in the field, we can't get a hold of him or something.
Oh, no.
And then later, they're talking about finding the body of Carl Phillips. And so, but the thing is, I couldn't get this out of my head. If you watch The Simpsons, they are two aliens on there named Kang and Kodos. And I kept thinking of that when I was listening to this because he describes them having tentacles. It's just a little thing of mine. I just thought it was funny because I kept thinking of them and not... I think H.G. Wells probably had a different version in mind of what kind of alien it was. So
with how this is, I'm not going to call him Orson now, too. It's just going to be our buddy old pal Orson.
Former Kenosian. From Kenosian. Yeah.
So, really, those silences, those moments where even slowly bringing back the music, it's not like that's the direct fear that's being played. It's more the person who's listening, what is your imagination making out of that silence? Right. Because you, like, radio, you don't have silence. You don't sit there and in silence for 20 seconds. Like, for example, like, if I just stop talking, that doesn't happen. You don't do that. It's awkward.
It's like, right, if you and I were doing this, and suddenly I stopped talking for 20 seconds.
Yeah, that is.
There you go. Someone might wonder if I fell on the floor or something.
Right? But it's just an example in a show that's completely sound-based. Silence is...
Right.
Sounds like something tragic happened.
And later in the broadcast, he does have where the aliens are like... In New York City, they're about... Because apparently they wipe out everyone in Times Square, which is funny because people actually ran down to Times Square, and of course nothing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's reporting, and he's saying, and they're coming out of the water. And he goes, oh, and he stops. But they leave the mic on. Like, you can still hear the ambient sound, like, around it. And then the mic cuts out after about 10 seconds. So I just thought, well, and later when eyewitnesses would talk about this, people who thought it was real, they would say it was the silences a lot of times that convinced them that something was happening.
Yeah.
Because he did it in such great spots. And he was really an innovator. Well, he was in filmmaking, too. So, I mean, he just took some of those things to film. There was... And I laughed. Well, not laughed, but... Well, I did. There's a small town called Concrete, Washington. And unfortunately for that town, they had a power outage.
Oh, no.
A blackout during the broadcast. It was totally a coincidence.
And so there are
so people are thinking, what's going on here?
Oh, you know? And there's no other way, because would the radios work by battery so that would still work, or they had to connect to it?
I think they were electricity, but I think some were battery back then too. But imagine if your thing goes out, your electricity goes out, your radio goes off, it's like, why did the electricity go off, you know?
Yeah.
You know, another thing that the aliens did was they were killing a lot of people with gas. Mm-hmm. And of course, people immediately, World War I, gas, because you say the black smoke is coming out. So people, these are things that people can identify as true. You know, gas was used in World War. We talked about it in other podcasts that gas was used. But really, there was starting in about the late 19th century, there was also a fascination with Mars by the general public. In 1877, an Italian astronomer named Schiaparelli, I think I got that right, he had come out with this, he said that he had noticed there were faint geometric lines on the surface of Mars, which he called canali in Italian. Now, this is important because in Italian, canali means channels. But when it got translated to English, it got mistranslated as canals.
Oh.
And in the 19th century, if you said canals, people associated that because the Panama Canal, which was early 20th century too, but people would associate this with a race of beings that were engineers that could build things. I just thought that was like this confluence of these things that were happening. Not that everyone who listened to it thought there was life on Mars, which is actually a good song by David Bowie. But... But yeah, so there was this, all this stuff was working into this. So the broadcast happens, then there's pandemonium, but there's not as much pandemonium as we think. And I think later scholars have studied this, have kind of concluded it wasn't as mass as people think. And I think the reason for that is there was real animus toward Wells from the newspaper people. And a lot of the newspaper people were kind of saying, you know what, we would never do this to our readers. We would never try to fool them. you know, this is this new medium of radio that's gone totally out of whack. Just substitute radio with internet, and there's really, you know.
You know, as if there's never been satire written before.
Exactly. And there's a book called Broadcast Hysteria, and it's by an author named A. Brad Schwartz. And I think the subtitle kind of sums it all up: Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News. And he sees it as the beginning of fake news because you're mixing entertainment with news. Now, I don't think, now he kind of takes a different view of this. I think most scholars take the view that this wasn't really that big of a deal. And there weren't people committing suicide. All these stories were sort of ginned up.
Yeah, and well, the thing with this one in particular, when you have a subheading of, you know, fake news in there, is that the thing with fake news is that it tries to be fake. It tries to be news.
Right.
Whereas Orson here, they said this is a work of fiction, listed as a work of fiction, and
right.
it's a show. Yes. Now it's a fictional show that sounds like it's trying to be real, but it identifies itself. That would be like The Onion saying,
right,
we're gonna do this actual broadcast, but it's on The Onion that says calls itself fake news.
Right.
So you know that it's. I would even say, I'm like, usually I don't say if I agree or disagree. That's like, that's an interesting take on that. That would be the beginning of fake news, but that could be the beginning of people showing that it's hard to prove something without full context, that they don't know if it's fake or real.
Right.
Or not.
Right. And so, yeah, and I mean, there were like 2 weeks, or this story kept going on. So it happened on October 30th. Like the end of November, they were still writing stories about it. There was like 12,500 news stories about this. And that's where people think it was the newspapers sort of giving it back to, I won't call him Orson, but giving it back to Welles, because they thought, well, you're going to get your comeuppance now, my friend, because... You know, you try to fool people, we wouldn't do that, you know. But it didn't stop people from listening to the radio. And there was actually a lot of people who wrote letters to CBS saying, don't change this, just because people thought it was, you know, don't, you know, we enjoyed it. A lot of people just took it for what it was and enjoyed it. So there was this split. I don't think it was as widespread. I remember when I was a kid, I don't even remember what it was, but I remember seeing something about this, and people were like jumping off bridges, and no one was actually doing that. And so I think it was just, and Welles, you know, they had to call this emergency press conference the next day on actual Halloween, ironically. And he was just going, I don't know anything about it. And later people said he knew what he was doing. He was just doing this. You know, he wasn't that sorry.
He's doing this press conference with this smug smirk on his face. That's what I'm imagining.
And later in his later life, he kind of didn't kind of laugh about it. Because him and Houseman were like laughing, like, who could believe this? We said it was fake, or it wasn't true, it was fiction. And then they started worrying about their careers because they saw how serious it was getting. CBS was having lawsuits filed against them. People were sending letters to Welles saying, you owe me a dollar, because I had to call my neighbors because I thought it was the end of the world. So there was a fair amount of people who believed it, but it wasn't the mass panic that people... There was a 2013, two media historians wrote in Slate that the supposed panic was so tiny as to be practically immeasurable on the night of the broadcast. Almost nobody was fooled. Well, I don't know if nobody was fooled. Somebody was, because some things did happen. And of course, there was a big traffic jam in Grover's Mills because it was like at a crossroads, and everyone was driving there to see aliens that weren't there.
Oh, yes. So the little community that was the target, it's hard to say target when they just pointed at it.
And why New Jersey? Well, I think because he only had a map of the New York area, so he just pointed and got Grover's Mills. Well, Grover's Mills did have some fun with this. So on the 50th anniversary in 1988, they had this big hoo-ha, and they put up a plaque. I think it's still there. How the Martians invaded them on 1938 on October 30th. And they had a 5K Martian fun run or something to go with it. So they had some fun with it.
I mean, yeah, when your town is subject to... I guess, a radio show that, I mean, we still talk about today.
We do.
This is the second time I've actually been a part of something talking about this specific show. I mean, you take that in pride, right? You put that in your history. You run the show a few times.
So. And really, what this really led to Orson Welles going and doing films, because the RKO Pictures said, huh, he's the boy, everyone called him the boy genius. And so they said, let's sign him so he can make a War of the Worlds movie. Of course, Orson Welles, being Orson Welles, decided to make Citizen Kane instead. So he wasn't going to make, because to him, War of the Worlds was done. He wanted to go forward. So he went to Hollywood, and the show got a sponsor. The Mercury Theater on the Air never had a sponsor, which was a big deal. So they became the Campbell's Playhouse. And of course, it didn't go very far after that, because they were all like, well, are we supposed to talk about chicken soup? No one really knew. And so Houseman went into other things. Welles went to Hollywood. But there is sort of a coda to this story. In 1949, a radio station, Ecuador of all places, in Quito, Ecuador, they decided to do this down there. So they decided to do this fake, and so they did it. But after about 20 minutes, they told everybody it was fake. Well, other stations had picked it up, but didn't pick up the other part of it. So people actually went down to the station, which doubled as the newspaper office, and started throwing rocks at it, and then set the place on fire.
Oh, no.
There were like five people killed in this conflagration. And that was the end. No one tried it again. Well, I mean, you can, because now people know it's...
Well, if you tried it again now, I mean, the internet exists.
right.
It would be so hard. I say this now. It would be so hard to do something as big as that.
Right. I think we will say, well, those people, they were dumber then or something. But look at all the kind of things people fall for on social media, mm-hmm. you know. But I think what sums it up is they were getting letters, and I'm going to quote one of them at the end here. This was a Maryland listener had written into the show and said, "It is my personal opinion that the average American, notwithstanding his public free education, is a humbug, a blatherskite," which I don't know what that is, "and a moron. He cannot sit to read a book for 2 hours, could give you no review if he read it, and cannot sit for 10 minutes to hear what is said, proof being that at least 4 times War of the Worlds was announced as fiction." And there were a lot of letters that ran pretty much against a lot of people. You know, they pretty much ran in that vein. Like, well, if people are that dumb, then they get what they deserve. So, that, and, you know, he had people saying, you know, this is your voters. And I kept thinking, this is the same stuff we hear today.
Yeah.
It's not much different.
I'm pretty sure, I mean, different words to call people.
Right.
Humbug isn't really used nowadays.
And blatherskite isn't really used that much either.
Whatever that is. Maybe we should bring that back. blatherskite back.
Like 23 Skidoo and other terms like that.
But I've heard similar phrases about media literacy today.
Yes.
By both media, public figures, I've heard the same thing said.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's hard to think. You know, we've seen things spread on Twitter that will be. I say Twitter because I think Twitter is probably one of the easiest places to see what is generally trending,
right,
across a region or a world.
Right.
But to see what's trending on there and see what people believe in or fall for.
Yes.
And then. I've done this a few times where I'll see someone tweet and they're going to be angry tweeting, and for some reason it brings someone up. Like someone gets popular, it gets spread around, mm-hmm. and then there's a second tweet that's talking about more, and then a third tweet is like, "Oh, I was wrong."
Right.
And that third tweet has a fraction of the traction that the first tweet did. So people still believe that first tweet. Despite what was said.
It's like Mark Twain's quote about, you know, a lie goes around the world while the truth's still putting on its shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, I think that's the quote, but that's sort of apropos to today, too.
Yeah, and so hearing that quote about this radio show, mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things. I think something that we've seen across this show multiple times now is that as much as history is there, it's written down. Someone's written it down a few times, actually, because you've little for people to know that when we do this in a studio, Scott often brings multiple books with him about the topic. Multiple books, citations.
And I haven't dropped one on my foot yet, so that'll be the next thing.
Yeah, and so a lot of what we talk about is something that's been studied, researched, by someone else. We just find the result of that research.
Right.
And yet, a lot of what's happened and what's said has repeated itself some way.
Oh yeah.
Some way, shape, or form, it's come back.
And I think, like I said, I think it reacted that way because it caught something of the zeitgeist, if you will, of that era. Like, I mean, could you have done it in the 50s? Probably not. It was something. It was like the moment and the show. It all came together.
Yeah.
So,
wow. I wonder how much more we're gonna get to talk about that we see similar, like almost direct similar veins where we can talk. I don't have a quote from someone directly right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll find one later is this exact same, but I know I've seen it. But knowing that and hearing that, where are we cruising through next time? somehow we're gonna have to go somewhere else. So where are we driving to?
Going back to the podcast we did on the search for the Ark of the Lost Covenant.
Okay.
And we were talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark and everything.
Yep.
Then I thought, well, you know, I seem to remember the Nazis actually really had an expedition somewhere, not to look for the Ark of the Covenant, but like they did in the movie. But they did send out people, and so I'm going to talk about the Nazi expedition to Tibet in 1938. And I don't think many people know about that, and it does have some importance. So.
Okay. Well, I am going to look forward to that. That sounds really fun. Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.